This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatto. You may have heard, I'm sure you've heard, of the Tuskegee syphilis studies in which hundreds of African-American men were deliberately infected with syphilis so that researchers could study them and see what syphilis does to the body. The men were not told about what was happening to them. There was no informed consent. And even after a cure for syphilis was available in an antibiotic form, the men were not treated. The studies were made public only after a reporter unearthed them, and the hearings that were held afterward helped bring about a change in the way medical research using human subjects is done. Tuskegee might be the most famous or infamous, but it is not the only case of abuse against black people by the medical establishment. From the era of slavery to the very recent past, black Americans have endured painful, often debilitating or sterilizing procedures, all done in the name of medical science. My next guest says that this long history of abuse has caused many black Americans to deeply mistrust the medical establishment, and it's contributed to the disparities in health care we have today. Harriet Washington is the author of Medical Apartheid, The Dark History of Medical Experimentation on Black Americans from Colonial Times to the Present. She is currently a visiting scholar at the DePaul University School of Law, and she joins me here in our New York bureau. Thanks for being with us today, Ms. Washington.
Thank you very much for having me,
Ira. Why did you write this book?
I wrote this book partly because of a personal experience, but largely because I knew that there was this shadowy culture among African Americans where fear of medical research and fear of medical care was very predominant and yet had been insufficiently examined. And what had really been almost ignored by medical historians and ethicists was an important factor, an important cause of this iatrophobia or fear of medicine, which I believe to be early and frequent and unfortunately persistent negative encounters with medical researchers. Mm-hmm. So I sought to examine historical records, look at old medical journals and physician memoirs, and find out exactly what had happened. And no one was more astonished than I at the volume that I unearthed.
About what you uncovered. And some of them very frightening stories would have never expected. Give us what the most shocking one for you was. Well, it's hard to pick them out. There's, you know.
And, you know, it's compounded by the fact that at this point I'm very difficult to shock. But I must
yeah.
say, one experience touched me personally to the point where I found myself crying on the train between New York City and Boston where I was doing a fellowship. And that was when I read the 1956-1957 medical journal articles written by a surgeon, a neurosurgeon named Orlando Andy, mm-hmm. University of Mississippi. He had written about how he took young black boys and he cut out parts of their brains, ablated part of their brains. These were living children, to try to cure their behavior disorders. But these behavior disorders were not things that had been certified by psychiatrists or psychologists. These were institutionalized boys. Their parents had little or no say about what was done to them. And I read one account where he, over the course of 5 or 6 years, did 6 or 7 surgeries, taking out various parts of the boy's brain and finally reporting that the boy was no longer a behavior problem. Well, I can well imagine that he wasn't because he didn't have enough personality left to be a behavior problem. And what chilled me, I think, was, first of all, it's a murder of a mind, and to do that to a child is just unspeakably cruel. And then you consider the very narrow range of acceptable behaviors for young black boys during that time. We're talking about the period during which Emmett Till
right.
was murdered on suspicion of whistling at a white woman.
Right.
So that I found just, you know, overwhelming. But the truth is there are so many negative episodes that many of them would eclipse that for other people.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. We're talking with Harriet Washington, author of Medical Apartheid, The Dark History of Medical Experimentation on Black Americans from Colonial Times to the Present. Let's talk about some of the abuses you document. There's this radiation experiment that was just amazing, conducted on unwilling or unwitting participants. You start a chapter of your book talking about a truck driver. This was amazing.
Yes.
Who was a kind of, let me just read the first few words. On a dewy spring morning in 1945, Robert S. Stone, M.D., a usually quiet, deliberate professor of radiology, burst into a neighboring office at the government's Oak Ridge, Tennessee nuclear facility, shouting, "Carl, I don't want to say what he called the truck driver.
The N-word.
The N-word that had his accident some time ago. And pick up the story. What happened to this truck driver?
Well, it's shocking. The truck driver's name was Ed Cabe, and he actually worked for the government indirectly driving trucks. However, he was in an accident. He was taken to the nearby hospital where the doctors assessed his condition as grave. He was a 55-year-old man in very, very good health. Mm-hmm. But they made the assessment that they didn't expect him to survive till morning. And as the physician whose quote you just read said, Carl Morgan said, you know, this is our chance. Robert Stone said, we're going to inject him with plutonium. What happened was the hospital that he had been brought to happened to be populated by doctors who were under contract to the Atomic Energy Commission, and they had been charged with taking more moribund hospital patients. Dr. Stone indicated that you take patients who are very sick and surreptitiously inject them with plutonium.
Not this just was, a little plutonium.
Oh, no. A whopping dose. A dose that was known to be
41 times the normal lifetime exposure.
Exactly. And when one considers that the half-life of plutonium is something on the order of 24,000 years, he was never going to get rid of this load of plutonium.
Now, what gave them the right to do these things?
What's interesting is that nothing gave them the right to do this. But during this time, we didn't have all the protections that we have today. Mm-hmm. Today, we have a matrix of laws that protect subjects. That existed only in a very rudimentary form then. We didn't really see a very comprehensive one until the Nuremberg Code after the war. What happened was these doctors were sanctioned by the government in a program that I categorize as secret. And people will contest that. They'll say, how can you say it's secret? There are documents laying it out. But it certainly was not transparent as far as the American people were concerned. People who were in hospitals expecting to be cared for by their doctors became subjects of these radiation experiments.
Mm-hmm. What kind of medical attention did slaves get back in those days?
Very, very good question. Very pregnant question. Because slaves, attention was paid to their fitness for work, not to their health. Mm-hmm. Very important distinction. And when you're watching an interaction between a physician and a slave, it may look very much like the interaction between a physician and a person who's not enslaved. But the truth is, if a physician cares for a person who is free, who is white, who has money, they're trying to bolster your health. With slaves, they wanted to increase their ability to do work, the ability to extract work for them, the ability for them to bear children that would be profitable for the master. And so very different rules governed it. For one thing, the care of the slave was dictated by the master's wishes. You had to do what the master wanted you to do. He had to be satisfied. He paid the physician. The physician satisfied him. So in every important sense of the word, it was the owner rather than the slave who was a patient. The slave was left outside, unconsulted, and with no recourse if he were harmed or killed or unsatisfied.
Having started the research on the book and finishing the research on the book and now thinking of everybody who will read the book, are people going to be, black people, going to be more fearful now of medicine than before? And do you find yourself more distrusting?
I will say for myself, I'm surprised at my reaction. I have to say that I have noticed that I'm a little slower than I used to be to discount things as conspiracy theories. Mm-hmm. I'm a little bit more tolerant, a little bit more open to considering, because I've learned so many things that seemed completely outlandish and possible actually happen. But I've never had any fear that I was going to make black people afraid of medical research or medical care. The truth is I can't. That's already been done by the people whose abuses I chronicle. Mm-hmm. You know, this hundreds of years of abuse and maltreatment in a research setting has already made black people fear. My hope is that I am going to initiate a dialogue. By bringing these cases into the light of day, I'm hoping that I am going to enrich the discussion. First of all, enrich our appreciation of medical history to encompass these things, and also to foster a discussion whereby when these abuses can no longer be denied, now we can discuss them and discuss ways of making sure they never happen again.
And there are still current issues coming up all the time. Let me just bring one up. The North Carolina legislature is proposing a plan to offer prisoners time off their sentences if they donate a kidney.
Yes.
What do you think of that?
I think it's...
Considering the prison population is proportionally black, that you're going to have more black people influenced.
Right. That's true. But whether they were black, white, Asian or anything else, the fact is that this is unconscionable. Mm-hmm. Essentially, if you tell a prisoner that if you give up an organ, you get time, that's the same thing as offering him payment. And payment schemes are becoming very popular in this country. And prison is a very troubling situation because prison research was all but ended in the 1970s in this country because of horrible abuses, unspeakable abuses. And recently, just this past fall, a federal panel recommended that prisons be opened again to research. This is only a harbinger of what's to come. I hope I am wrong. I hope I will be proven wrong, but I feel certain that we're about to see a renaissance of the same horrible abuses that we put an end to 25 or 30 years ago.
Because?
Because prison is an essentially coercive environment. You know, I don't think you can have voluntary informed consent in a prison. Prisoners have lost most important civil rights. They're in a very hostile, you know, environment in which violence is present. They desperately need money. And the whole nature is coercive. So these are people who don't actually have free will, and that makes informed consent impossible, and that makes research with them just unconscionable. The excuse is often given that we have to do research to give them medical care. Prisoners desperately need medical care, so give them medical care, but don't make them research subjects.
Mm-hmm. And they have no choice, basically.
In my opinion, it's not really voluntary. You know, they don't really have a choice because the kind of the Hobson choices get offered a prisoner are not things that you and I are ever presented with. And lose an organ or have bail money that may enable you to get out of jail. That's not a choice.
And as Woody Allen said, in such small portions, I mean, they're offering 6 months for a kidney.
That's absurd. It's almost insulting. But it really is. Just unacceptable.
All right. We're gonna come back and talk lots more with Harriet Washington about her book, A Medical Apartheid. Very interesting stories in the book, very frightening stories. Maybe you'll have some you want to share with us of your own experiences. Our number, 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this short break. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about the history of medical experimentation on Black Americans. My guest is Harriet Washington, author of Medical Apartheid, The Dark History of Medical Experimentation on Black Americans from Colonial Times to the Present. And while we were during the break, she reminded me that I misspoke about the Tuskegee experiments. The gentlemen were not injected with syphilis. They already had it, right? Thank you. Thank you for pointing that out. The syphilis studies didn't hurt just men, though, who were infected. The wives and children of the men and the people in the surrounding community suffered, too. And my next guest has tried to help address some of that suffering in a rather unique way. The Bioethics Quilt Project brought together some of the women in the surrounding community to talk about their experiences and at the same time to sew quilts. Pictures of some of the quilts are on our website at sciencefriday.com, right there on the homepage. You click on it, you get to a collection of all the quilts there. Joining me now to talk more about it is the director of the Bioethics Quilt Project. Mujeh Shakir is assistant professor of occupational therapy at Tuskegee University. She's also a bioethics senior scholar at the National Center for Bioethics in Research and Healthcare there. She joins us from Tuskegee, Alabama. Thanks for being with us today.
It's my pleasure.
You know, it sounds a little bit like the AIDS quilt.
It does.
Tell us about this idea.
Well, I was interested in learning more about the stories of women in particular because, as you probably know, the study itself involved men. And, you know, given the nature of how syphilis is transmitted, the story of women and the women in the lives of these men and also their children, you know, has not been told. It's a discussion that just has not really been had. Mm-hmm. And I wondered about the impact of the syphilis study on their lives and also on the life of the community. And so I thought of bringing a group of women together, also because quilting is a culturally significant activity that that people still do in this particular part of the country, they still engage in that quite a bit. And as an occupational therapist, I thought, well, what a fine way to bring a group of women together and to have them engage in this projective medium to begin a dialogue, but also to end up with something really tangible, like a quilt that could be hung and shown and stimulate public conversations about the study.
Now, each of these people tell their own story in one panel on the quilt?
No, the quilt is made up of squares. It's not a full panel. It's a maybe a 16 by 16 inch square, and each square does sort of tell a story, but when you put it all together, it tells a bit of a story.
Mm-hmm. And who are these people?
I had one group in 04 who was a group of all of the women are retired senior citizens. The oldest woman in the group was 97. The youngest woman in the group is 51. And they are just women in the community. Mm-hmm. Some of them are professional women, but most of them are working class, non-professional women. Some of them had relatives that were in the study, but the majority of this particular group were just folks from the community.
When they get around and do their quilting, do they tell stories about what was happening in those days?
Yes. You know, I explained to them that what the purpose of the project was all about, and so I actively elicited the stories. One of the things that we learned is that there's still a lot of silence about the syphilis study. I mean, mm-hmm. big secrets, you know, in the community. And I thought and believe that the quilting made it easier for people to tell and to talk about something that was pretty painful.
Mm-hmm. Harriet, if you want to jump in, and you know, anytime, and just feel free to say something. Did they talk about Nurse Rivers, who was I understand she was an African American and she knew what was happening to the men, but she didn't try to stop it.
Yes, it comes up quite a bit, and there's always a mixed kind of response, a mixed review. There's some of the women were angry and felt mm-hmm. that she had betrayed the men and the race. And others had a very compassionate understanding of the complexities of the dynamics of what was happening in that particular time period, and knew of her commitment to the community as a public health nurse, and actually, like I said, felt very compassionate towards her, mm-hmm. and did not believe that she should be held totally responsible.
I'm glad that we're talking about Eunice Rivers, because I think black complicity is a very important part of what I've discussed in my book and part of this history. And she has been made, in my opinion, to bear a disproportionate part of the burden of the study. If we look at the Tuskegee syphilis study, which actually was a public health service study, with Tuskegee only marginally involved, the architects of the study were PHS physicians, very powerful men, government physicians, Taliaferro Clark, O.C. Wenger, Raymond Vondelier, and Surgeon General Thomas Perrin. These men put together the study and propagated it. Eunice Rivers was a public health nurse in rural Alabama, a black nurse, arguably at the very bottom of the medical totem pole. Mm-hmm. You know, the degree of her agency is very, very limited. And although personally, I wish she had asked more questions about the study, mm-hmm. I think it's unrealistic to expect her to have had much agency in terms of ending its course.
Professor Shakir, are the quilts visible or, you know, open to the public to see any place?
Not at this particular time. However, I am available to give talks and to bring the quilts around. Probably at some point in time in the near future, they will be on display for people to see.
Well, I want to thank you for taking time to talk with us, and good luck to you.
And thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Muja Shakir is Assistant Professor of Occupational Therapy at Tuskegee University. She's also a bioethics senior scholar at the National Center for Bioethics and Research in Healthcare there, and she joined us from Tuskegee, Alabama. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Is our number still with us? Is Harriet Washington, author of Medical Apartheid, The Dark History of Medical Experimentation on Black Americans from Colonial Times to the Present. Harriet, do you still think there's unethical things?
There are unethical things still transpiring, but I hasten to add that they pale in comparison to what happened in the past. the horrible abuses of the past almost never happen mm-hmm. anymore. We no longer see black people herded into hospitals, of segregated hospitals, where they are experimented on to devise new procedures or just to train physicians. That doesn't happen anymore. But there are problems, there are abuses, and a lot of them are racially disproportionate. In large part, they fall under what I call the erosion of consent. Since 1990, there have been a variety of laws passed, part of the Code of Federal Regulations, that have been watering down the concept of informed consent, mm-hmm. which has been sacrosanct in medical research here. And black people are suffering disproportionately from that. I think, for example, of the artificial blood studies that have been conducted in Detroit until fairly recently, whereas if you were brought into an emergency department in Detroit and six other centers across the country, unconscious, you need blood, you may be given blood, or you might get artificial blood, which in this case is old, expired human blood. And the person deciding it is not a physician who looks at your clinical picture. It's a computer. And this study only ended about 6.5 weeks ago, not because there was an ethical complaint or a public outcry, but because the company, Northfield Laboratories, had all the data that it wanted and ended the study. We're going to see more of these.
So you're saying it's unethical to withdraw the artificial blood from these people?
I'm saying it's unethical to give someone an experimental therapeutic, mm-hmm. including artificial blood, without getting their permission. These people are unconscious. So nobody's even asked them, are you willing to be part of research? If they were giving
No matter what race you are.
No matter what race you are. That's why I said, you know, it affects blacks and whites. Yeah. However, if you look at the demographics, you find that black people are more likely to use the emergency department as a private physician than whites. And also, many emergency departments, like the one in Detroit, are located in heavily inner city areas. Mm-hmm. So you do see more, proportionately more black people than white.
1-800-989-8255. Kimberly in St. Louis. Hi, Kimberly.
Hi, good afternoon.
Hi there.
My question is twofold. Firstly, I'm originally from Maryland, and there is certainly a pervasive belief in Baltimore City, especially amongst the older people, that back in the day that you were not to go seek treatment at Johns Hopkins because apparently people would go get treatment and come back worse off than where they were, or they would just not be seen ever again. And I was wondering if Ms. Washington had ever found any evidence of that. And secondly, I've known several black men in my family friends, who just seem to die, be it from cancer, a variety of other types of illnesses, but they die like in their early 50s. I mean, I know some. I mean, my father passed away at 53, and I knew several other black men in that age range to die around that age. And is that an across-the-board thing? Or, I mean, do black men just do not live to see 70, 80 years old? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you very much.
Right. Thank you.
Hi. Yes, I have heard very often people voice the fears about Johns Hopkins University. What I have found is that, not pertaining to Johns Hopkins in particular, but at hospitals in general, there again, there is a grain of truth to people's fears, because the truth is, earlier in our nation's history, black people were treated in separate clinics and separate wings of the hospital, and they were expected to undergo research as payment for having been treated in the charity wards. But yet, if you were black, you couldn't go into a regular paying ward. And so it's true that sometimes people would go into the hospital and have procedures such as amputations done simply as part of medical training, not because it was medical indicated. And that was a horrific thing. It doesn't happen now, but the memory, of course, of these things persists. And there also are fears of birking, which is being killed for anatomical dissection. And I did find one documented case of that. It happened to a white woman, not a black person. A white woman who lived in a black area. It doesn't mean that didn't happen to other people. But thankfully, it's among the abuses that I think we can place firmly in the past. In terms of the death of black men, I think that was actually a quite prescient question on your part, because I think we're going to be talking more about that later
on. Let's bring them on now.
Yeah. Okay, great.
Let's talk about, we've heard many times before how white people are living longer than black people on the average. And the numbers are a little different for men and women, but the outcome's the same. You live longer on the average if you're white. And now there's a new study in the Journal of the American Medical Association that says that the gap in life expectancy between blacks and whites has narrowed a bit, And even though that sounds like good news, the authors are quick to point out that the gap remains substantial. And joining me now to talk more about the gap and some of the reasons is Sam Harper. He's a research fellow in the Department of Epidemiology at McGill in Montreal, and he joins us by phone. Thanks for being with us today, Dr. Harper.
Glad to be with you.
Let's start with some definitions. Tell us what we mean by a life expectancy gap.
Sure. Well, life expectancy is basically a way of summarizing mortality. So one way to think of it is sort of as the average lifespan that would be expected for an individual living under sort of the current mortality conditions. So, for example, life expectancy in the United States is currently about 78 years, meaning that on average, an individual born today can expect to live to about 78. Now, that's the average for the United States as a whole. The average life expectancy for whites is about 78.1 currently, but for blacks is about 72.7. So there's about a 5.5-year gap at present between blacks and whites. Mm-hmm. So that's what we mean by the gap.
I got you. And how has the gap changed over the years, and how has it shrunk?
Well, as you pointed out, for most, actually, since we've been recording mortality statistics, life expectancy has been higher for whites than for blacks. Mm-hmm. But for most of the 20th century, the size of that gap has been declining. However, we did see during the 1980s a rapid increase in the gap. And subsequently, over the past decade or so, we've actually seen a rather rapid decline in the gap.
We're talking about life expectancy this hour with the blacks versus whites on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News, talking with Sam Harper. So why does the gap persist, Dr. Harper?
Well, one of the things we looked at was trying to look at different causes of death and how they might contribute to this gap. So in terms of the existing gap that we see, we found that among men, about 30% of that gap is due to black-white differences in cardiovascular disease. And similarly, among women, we see cardiovascular disease accounts for about 40% of the existing gap. So clearly, that's a major component to the gap.
Mm-hmm. Is this because of medical care being different?
That's certainly an element of why we might observe this contribution to the gap. Clearly, we know that for some risk factors for cardiovascular disease, in particular things like hypertension and diabetes, we know that blacks tend to have higher levels of these risk factors than whites do. Mm-hmm. So clearly, those things are potentially targets that could be addressed through the medical care system.
Mm-hmm. People ask also, perhaps there's a genetics difference.
Well, I think we don't have much evidence at this point that that makes much of a contribution to this difference in lifespan, and it seems very unlikely that it makes any really contribution to this decline in the gap that we saw over this recent decade.
Mm-hmm. So you really don't understand what the decline in the gap is.
Well, we do in terms of understanding sort of the major causes of death that contributed to the decline. Really, we found that actually it was really down to only a few causes. About 70% of the decline among men was due to only three causes of death. So that was improvements in homicide, HIV/AIDS, and unintentional injuries. And those same factors also improved the gap among women, although among women we also did see improvements in heart disease mortality make an important contribution to reducing the gap over this period. So that's at least some sign of progress.
Mm-hmm. 1-800-989-8255 is the number. Harriet Washington, do you think it's worth investigating the genetic differences?
No. Because of something called Occam's razor, the scientific principle saying that it's not necessary to invoke genetics. We know of the many very dramatic causes. And frankly, if you look at the causes of death of black people, we're talking about genetics contributing to 0.5%. Mm-hmm. That's less than one death in 200. So that we know that many of the things Dr. Harper's investigated, heart disease, HIV disease, diabetes, infant mortality, we know these to be gross contributors. So it's not necessarily, I think, to invoke any sort of genetic approach when we know exactly what diseases are carrying us off in greater numbers.
Mm-hmm. Sam Harper, you agree?
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And also, it's worth mentioning that we actually, you know, we already know quite a bit about how to change sort of the environmental, that is to say, non-genetic determinants of these diseases. So we know how to sort of treat things like hypertension and high cholesterol. And we also know, you know, how to try to work to get people to improve their lifestyles, mm-hmm. such as improving their diets and maintaining healthy weights. And again, we don't need to, as you said, we don't need to invoke genetics to explain what we observed in our study.
Mm-hmm. So you saw the gap change. We'd have to take a break, so stay with us.
Sure.
We're going to have to come back right after the short break. We'll be right back. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. This hour, for the rest of the hour, for a little bit more, we're going to talk about medical ethics and experimentations on African Americans over the years. And with me is Harriet Washington. She is author of Medical Apartheid, also talking with Sam Harper at McGill University. And I've got time for one more question, Harry. I want to ask you, Martin Luther King spoke of the inequality of the American healthcare system. In your book, you talk about it in a speech he gave in Montgomery in 1965. He said, "Of all the forms of inequality, injustice in health is the most shocking and the most inhumane."
Yes.
Hard to amplify on that, is it?
I think that says it all.
Do you think enough attention is paid now to inequality in healthcare?
I think we're making great progress. You know, work like Dr. Harper's, initiatives such as Dr. Satcher set in progress when he was Surgeon General, mm-hmm. where it was very ambitious, but it was important that it was done. It gave an impetus so that we now have attention turned to the importance of resolving healthcare disparities, because in the end, you know, we're medically interdependent. Mm-hmm. And I think it's real folly to say that any of us is going to enjoy good health when we have pockets of people who are sick and disaffected.
Sam Harper, you agree?
I do agree. And I think it's actually quite interesting that Professor Washington mentions Dr. Satcher, because that's also a good example of areas where we can think about making success if we really sort of redouble our efforts toward addressing this problem. I think one of the things he really tried to look at was reducing race-ethnic disparities in childhood immunizations. And as a result of really focusing on this problem in particular, we've actually come quite a long way toward, reducing that gap. So I think that's, it's a positive. We can affect this problem, but we do need to work harder. Mm-hmm.
Sam Harper, I want to thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thanks very much for having me.
Sam Harper is a research fellow in the Department of Epidemiology at McGill University in Montreal. Harriet Washington, thank you.
Thank you, Ira.
She's author of Medical Apartheid, The Dark History of Medical Experimentation on Black Americans from Colonial Times to the Present. It is an eye-opening book, and thank you for writing it. She's currently visiting scholar at the DePaul University School of Law.